Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the Albion Roar Down Under, sponsored by Pure Media. This show is for those Brighton and Hove Albion expats and local converts here in Australia and New Zealand. My name is Richard Parker here in Auckland, New Zealand, and joining me every week is the founder of Seagulls Down Under fan club, Steve Longley. Yesterday we saw another home draw, this time against Stoke City. That's five unbeaten now and still nicely positioned in the top half of the table. We'll be discussing the penalty that never was and also be looking forward to the long-awaited clash with Crystal Palace. We'll be reminiscing on previous derby games, and ex-Albion Paul Reid talks about his experience playing in the 2005 game when Paul McShane headed the winner for the Albion at Selhurst Park. This week, Steve and myself are joined by a very special guest. He is a Brighton-born ex-Crystal Palace winger who has played in an FA Cup final and also made the move from the UK to play Down Under in the A-League for the Wellington Phoenix. It's Paul Eiffel. Hello.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us.
No problem.
So first of all, I want to ask you, when you were growing up, who did you support?
I had a season ticket at Brighton, so I did support Brighton, but Brighton were in the lower leagues then, and you had to have a Premier League team or a bigger team, we used to call it, and my team was Newcastle United.
All right, how come?
I was a glory hunter. I used to follow, back in the day, Liverpool, Arsenal, whoever was winning, really. And my mate said to me, look, you need to pick a team here. This is getting ridiculous. You know, maybe it needs to be the kit. So I like black and white stripes. So it was Notts County and Newcastle. And again, still moaning. So they said, look, when they play each other, whoever wins, you can carry on supporting them from then on. So Newcastle won that game and I've supported them since.
So do you still follow the Albion?
I do, yes. I mean, I've still got so many friends and family back there. You know, they've been going mad over the last couple of years talking about the new stadium and the fact that it will be used for the Premier League one day. Now, I thought it'd be a long time off, but obviously after last season's unbelievable run, it's nice to see it in use this year.
So we'll talk about your career in a bit, but I think we just want to gloss over the 2-2 draw with Stoke City. Steve, what was your feelings about the game?
It was a funny old game, really, to be honest. I would have taken a draw at the start of the game, being that we won the two away games, so it sort of evened itself out, really. I couldn't understand the people that were moaning about it. A point's a point at the end of the day, and the more points we rack up, the better. So I thought it showed a lot of character to come back twice from, you know, 1-0 down, 2-1 down. So I was quite happy with the point. So I don't really understand those people that were, you know, on social media having a moan about it.
Yeah, I have to agree. I think this game felt more like a point gained than 2 points lost, especially as we were down twice. But, I, the penalty, we have to talk about it. How's the referee not giving that one?
I don't know. Even Shawcross after the game said it was a penalty. What can you do? You just get up and move on. He's not going to give it. That's it.
Paul, did you watch the game at all?
I didn't. No, I was following it on Twitter.
There's a call after that penalty decision that wasn't for video replays, and I think they're going to introduce them into the Premier League. As a player, how would you feel about that if you were obviously playing in the Premier League now and the game was stopped for X amount of minutes to review decisions? Good thing or not?
Well, they're actually doing it in the A-League at the moment. And, you know, some people love it, some people hate it, and I think they just need to get it right. At the moment, in the A-League, it goes, the referee decides to call for VAR. It can happen while the game is still playing at times. There's been incidents where, you know, there's a penalty decision pending and the other team are attacking at the other end. And the ball goes out of play and he proceeds to walk 100 metres up the other end of the pitch and give a penalty.
So really?
I think you need to get it right. The play needs to be stopped and a panel of, you know, an ex-referee and an ex-player maybe on the panel upstairs need to be able to give it, but within, you know, 30 seconds. They need to be able to watch it in real time, watch it one replay, and then give it, and that's that.
So there's a penalty appeal, and the game carries on. The other team goes down, the other end scores, but the ref goes, oh, actually, no, it's a penalty. Their goal gets disallowed, and they pull it all the way back to the other end to give a penalty.
Yeah, if you go on Google, and literally, I don't know what the wording would be, but Google what you've just talked about, it actually happened in a Dutch Premier League game, very long ago at all. Exact situation, pen should have been given. They attacked, went down the other end, scored a goal. They're in the middle of celebrating, referees, gone to VAR, awards the pen, they score the pen. And I think it was in the Dutch Super Cup final, actually. Mm.
Wow. Okay. Well, they do need to sort that out. I guess the problem is that if you are then, you know, you're stopping the game and you're waiting for video replays, the players are going to get annoyed if that's going to constantly happen. Can the referee stop it for anything?
They're not supposed to be. There's supposed to be certain rules, but they call it match-changing incidents, I think. So penalties, people going through goal scoring situations, even offsides, offside goals in particular, they can call back. So it just doesn't work. I think it has to be really quick, and it needs to, or maybe even a challenge system. And there are, each coach has got one challenge per game, and he's allowed to challenge the ref. They can stop the game, and it's going to go on for 1 minute, and each team's got one they can pick from.
Yeah, there was a game, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, I think it was a Sydney game, where the game stopped and he went over to the monitor, the referee, and had a look at it on the monitor. I thought that was ridiculous, because surely, the reason for wearing headphones is that he gets told all this from above. He isn't going to go and look at the monitor. And, it's Sydney FC. They've got the biggest screens in the world up there. You can just watch it.
Maybe he didn't believe the guy who was telling them. Seems a bit irrelevant, then, if you've got a guy looking at the screen and goes, no, I don't believe you, I have to look at it myself.
I don't like it at all. I think it's gone down the way of rugby league and rugby union. I'm not a great lover.
Going back to the game, it was a good point, as you say. We move on to probably the easiest game of the season at Old Trafford on Saturday.
Yeah, that will be interesting.
I think it's one of those games you can just go there and enjoy it.
Oh, yeah, I think... the fans will have a great time. They'll have a great day out. We're not expecting great things. But, I think we will be hard to break down. I just hope if they do break us down, our heads don't go down and give a good account of ourselves like we did against Man City, really.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the Albion Roar Down Under, sponsored by Pure Media. If you'd like to get in touch with us, please email us, albionroardownunder@gmail.com. So let's talk to Paul a little bit more about his career. So you started your career at the mighty Saltdean United, my local team.
That's correct, yeah, many moons ago. I started at nine, played a couple of seasons, went back off to Bridgeview in Lewis for a few seasons. And then I came back, I think I was 15 when I came back, and played in the youth team for sort of half a season, then got into the first team there. I think I was just 16 when I got in the first team.
Was it right you played alongside your dad in that team?
Yeah, he was only a couple of times. He was right at the end of his career, and I was, like I said, I'm maybe 15, 16, so I played a couple of times next to him, but not much. By that point, he was older than I am now, so he was struggling along a bit, but it was pretty cool to be able to play next to your dad.
Was he a forward as well?
He was a centre forward, yeah. He scored a lot more goals than me at that level, that's for sure.
Yeah. and then you got picked up by Millwall.
Yeah, I was at Saltdean and doing quite well, and like I said, in the first team at 16, and scoring goals, and it meant that a few scouts were coming to watch the games. There was a couple of us in that team that had done quite good things at sort of 16, 17. I was offered a trial by Millwall, a trial by Portsmouth, and a trial by Newcastle United, actually. I went to the trial at Portsmouth first. Drove all the way down there. This is the days before mobile phones. We get there and the game's been called off and no one had told us. That was the end of my first trial. Went up to Millwall, played in a reserve game against Crystal Palace. And I always remember in the game that Bruce Dyer was playing and he was the first ever £1 million teenager. Yeah, I rocked up at 16. I was so far out of my depth, it was frightening. I was absolutely awful. Came off the pitch after the game and my dad was there and he's not this type of guy, but he gave me a big hug and I knew what he meant. He meant you've messed up your lines here. You've had a stinker. And, I was devastated, and the chief scout came down and said, look, how did you think you did? And I said, oh, I was out of my depth, I was awful. And he said, oh, look, we've been watching you over the last couple of weeks, we know what you can do, we knew this would be too much for you at this point, but we wanted to see what your character was like. And they said, every time you got knocked off the ball, you went to try and win it back. Every time you fell over, you got back up and tried to get back on the ball. Every time you crossed it in the stand, you got back on the ball and crossed it in the stand again. We just wanted to see if you had the character, we can coach the rest. So they said, we'd like to offer you a 1 year contract as a youth training scheme. And the only other option on the table was obviously Newcastle United trial. Now, supporting Newcastle United, I wanted to go there, but mum and dad talked me around and said, look, great opportunity to go to a club that's got a good youth system, pretty renowned for that, and you'll probably get a chance rather than going up to Newcastle where you might not even get in. And you might not get a chance, so I signed it 2 days later.
How long until you made it into the first team?
I did a whole year in the youth team, and had a bloody good year actually. Played a bit in the reserves, and then got my professional contract at the end of that. And then it was about halfway through the second season. I was training quite well, and two right wingers got injured, and the third choice right winger got suspended. And at that point, I was a centre forward, but I was quick, and they just chucked me in on the right and said, look, you're going to start, you're going to make your debut away to Lincoln, of all places, and I did. Didn't play again for a good few games, and then played the last, I think, 15 games of the season in the end.
And who was the manager at that point?
The manager, it was joint manager, it was Alan McCleary and Keith Stevens.
And then FA Cup final, 2004, against Manchester United. Yep. That must have been one hell of an experience.
Yeah, it was just a crazy year, really. It was, you start the year, you hoping to have a decent cup run, and really our aim that year was to get promoted to the Premier League.
Yep.
I remember winning the semi-final against Sunderland, and we were in fourth in the league, and we were beating everybody. We really fancied ourselves to get promoted that year. We won one game between the semi and the final because everybody took their eye off the ball and was just concentrating on playing that final.
Was Dennis Wise in the side then?
Dennis Wise was player coach at that point because Mark McGee had been sacked earlier in the season. Dennis had taken over and led us to the final. He was player coach, yeah.
And what was the experience itself? Obviously, the result didn't turn out for you, but the overall experience, playing Manchester United, was it at Cardiff?
Yeah, it was at Cardiff, yeah. I think 78,000 people. I just remember walking out in the tunnel and seeing Roy Keane, Ryan Giggs. There was just Paul Scholes. It was frightening. And at that point, I'd never played in the Premier League, so I'd only ever seen these guys on TV. So to be stood in the tunnel, knowing they're going to go out and play in front of millions of people on TV, it was pretty daunting, but it was an excellent experience.
And then the move to Sheffield United the following season, how did that come about?
One of them funny ones, Neil Warnock's always been a guy that signs players that do well against his clubs.
Yep.
He told me that once he signed me, but if you look at my record, I think I've scored more goals, or the second most amount of goals in my career was against Sheffield United. I think I'd scored six in sort of 3 years against them. And he came in and paid, I think it was 800,000, rising to a million if we got promoted, and we duly got promoted to the Premier League that first season.
And what was Neil Warnock like as a manager to play under?
Blimey. As a man manager, he was good. He always had me feeling like I was the best player in the league when I went out. Whether that was true or not is a different matter, but I always felt like that. He gave me that confidence in terms of actually sort of tactical awareness and setting teams up to play. He was not very good. He was very average, in fact. But every single person went out there and gave everything, and that's what he demanded. There was no hiding place. He'd let you know all about it if you didn't do what he wanted, but then didn't always tell you what he wanted in the first place. So it made it quite difficult.
He seems like one of those managers that the opposing fans love to hate. Brighton fans don't have a particularly good opinion of him, Steve, do they?
No, he's one of those sort of Brian Clough type characters, isn't he? You either love him or you hate him. He's done well with the teams that he's been with. He's kept teams up in the Premier League, and you can't really knock him too much. I mean, I know Paul's saying that his tactical awareness may not have been all that. In a way, he's a bit like Chris Hughton, isn't he? He sort of sets his teams up to do what he wants them to do, and, Chris does that with his team. He sets them up. He knows that we're not going to win every game. And you get certain managers that do that sort of thing.
Man management is such a big part of a manager's job. They have first team coaches, and I guess they go through tactics. But if that manager can relay to his players, put them in a real positive mind, tell them they're going to win.
Yeah, and that's what Brian Clough used to do, didn't he? When he'd tell them they'd go out there and they were going to win, he took players that were past their sell-by date, some of them, and they ended up becoming European champions. That sort of mindset from a manager like that. Big Sam does it. He's got that same sort of mindset, and there's two or three other managers down the years that have done the same sort of thing. Those managers that either keep teams up or give the team self-belief, that's the thing. And I think Chris Hughton does that with ours. Correct me if I'm wrong, Paul, but I think that's what Neil did with the teams that he managed. Is that right?
Yeah, I'd say so. I think Chris would be a better manager. He seems to have got them really, really well structured. I don't know whether that's his first team coach or that's a bit of both. But I mean, the belief. I think you just got to look at the belief the other night, like coming from behind twice against a decent Stoke side, shows that things are going well. And five games unbeaten in the Premier League, you must be doing something right in terms of getting the players' mindset right.
Yeah, absolutely. And from Sheffield United, you moved to Crystal Palace as a Brighton lad. Did you have any doubts about joining Crystal Palace, or did that? You didn't even think about that. You just thought, "Yep, this is the right move for me."
Oh, the Brighton thing didn't even come into it, but the Millwall thing did. You guys obviously don't particularly like Palace, but trust me, Millwall hate Palace just as much. So I knew as a former Millwall player, and I suppose as a Brightonian, that if I didn't hit the ground running at Palace, then I was going to have a real tough time. But I'd fallen out of favour at Sheffield with Neil Warnock, and I just wanted to play, and I wanted to be back closer to my family. So I had offers from Leeds and Palace. And at the time, Dennis Wise was the Leeds coach, actually, so it was pretty hard to turn him down. But I really felt that at the time, Palace was the right move, and it wasn't in the end. I probably moved for the wrong reasons. Was injured a hell of a lot. The Palace fans didn't really see the best of me, unfortunately. And I was always sort of trying to come back from injury, then I'd get injured again, and it was just a pretty terrible time. So, I mean, considering all that, the Palace fans were actually pretty good with me, because for the money they paid, I didn't really give them too much back.
When you're injured for a long time, do you find that sometimes you rush yourself back, and then that's when, you know, perhaps you can get injured again?
That was the case. I mean, I think I had, in 2.5 years there, I had 16 different hamstring injuries, and it was nearly all of them were for that exact reason. I played in games that I should never have played in. I remember, honestly, I must have had that season. I must have had 10 fitness tests before games, literally going in, not sure if it's right, but just trying to get through it. I'd come off injured, patch myself up, try and have another fitness test the next week, and it just went on and on, and it was a terrible time, and like I said, they definitely didn't see the best to me at all.
So did you find when you first joined Crystal Palace that the fans were a bit cagey towards you, weren't too sure?
Yeah, they were. I mean, most of it was a little bit of banter, you know, you get the guys in the car park when you arrive at the game, you better do well down here, ex-Millwall boy, and all this sort of stuff. And, you know, you take it with a pinch of salt. But, you know, they're passionate fans, and they're good fans. So I haven't got anything bad to say about the Palace fans. They having a tough time of it this year, that's for sure. But, you know, I hope they stay up.
And Neil Warnock, he became manager of Palace when you were there.
He did, yeah. That was a nice surprise. So, the day that he let me go to Palace, he actually said to me, he said, be good down there. I said, what do you mean? He said, be good, because you never know when you're going to see me next. And then he walks in, you know, whatever it was, the following season, and I'm sat in the canteen, and the boys are waiting for him, and he comes straight over to me. He goes, I told you, wifey. I said, I'll be back and see you soon, didn't I?
And what was your reaction?
I thought, my days are numbered. I'm going to be off again. And I'd only been there, I think, a year. And then within about a month from there, he put me on the transfer list, and I thought, that's me done. And as it happened in the end, even though I was on the transfer list, I played 38 games for him that season. So he did give me an opportunity, and he offered me a contract at the end of the season, actually, another year, but I turned it down because I wanted to leave. We were in the Championship at that point, so I'd left Sheffield, who were in the Premier League, and I'd gone back to Palace thinking, because Palace had just been relegated, and I thought, you know, we'll do well this year. We'll get straight back up, and I'll be back in the Premier League. But we never quite managed it.
When a manager comes in, do you find that they're always honest with you? Or sometimes a manager will come up to you and say, yeah, you're in my plans. You know, I'm really keen for you to play. And then they don't play you.
Oh, I think every manager's different. I've had some managers that were just absolute liars and just told you what they thought you wanted to hear to keep you happy. But I've always been the guy that just wants the truth. If I'm not good enough, that's no problem at all. Tell me what I need to work on. If I still can't make it, then let me go. And I've always been that way. Even to this day, you know, I'm still playing local football, and that's all I want. I want the truth from the coach. Otherwise, I don't think you've got any way of trying to improve yourself. It's impossible. So that was always the case. And to be fair to Warnock, he was, as much as I didn't particularly like him at times, he didn't beat around the bush. If he didn't think I was doing the business, he'd tell me. And he'd tell me why I wasn't in the team, so that was fair enough.
At Crystal Palace, you were there at a time when there was, unfortunately, no game against Brighton. There was no derby game. We were in League One. But were you aware of the rivalry at all when you got there? Now, obviously, you're from Brighton, so you're going to know about it, you know, from that point of view. But I'm interested to know from someone who played for Crystal Palace, if there's any mention of the rivalry, anybody really cares about it, or is there somebody else? I guess it really does depend if you're in the same league as that team, but because it's such a long-standing rivalry.
Yeah, I think it's more the fans, to be honest. It was never spoken about. I mean, at the time I was at Palace, we had a couple of games against other London clubs, and it was talked about in our league, you know, you want to be the best London club in the league. With Brighton, there was a little talk about it, but because they weren't in our league, you kind of just think that they're your noisy neighbours that don't deserve to be spoken about, if you know what I mean. They're not they're not relevant at the time, and it's only when they get promoted into the same league that I think the rivalry starts up again.
There is a bit of that, isn't there? But, you know, the rivalry between the fans is always going to be there, doesn't matter what division.
Yeah, yeah, you know? I agree.
Same with Newcastle and Sunderland. They're still anti each other, no matter what division they're in. And I think, you know, with the players, it's a bit different because they come and go. They don't know the rivalry. Obviously, you do, Paul, because you're a Brighton boy.
Yeah.
No, it's a bit, it's slightly different. But obviously, it comes to the fore more when you're in the same division. You can't help but look at your rival's results, even if you're in a different division, to see how they're doing. And you think, oh, God, they're doing well. Great, they're doing badly or whatever. Paul, was there ever an interest from the Albion for you?
Yeah. Before I came out to the Phoenix, actually, I was going to sign for Brighton.
Yeah.
It was Russell Slade was the coach at the time. And I actually was training with Brighton. Went down. I think you just signed Dickinson.
Yeah.
Yeah, Dickinson had just signed for the club. And I remember going down and training. And my agent had told me what you'd paid for Dickinson and how much money he was on. And then I was offered a deal, and it was about a third of what Dickinson was on. And I'm thinking, well, and I actually trained with the lad. And this is no disrespect to him, but I was thinking, if they think he's a better player than me, they're mad.
You're not the only one thinking that, Paul.
Yeah. He didn't prove to do much, did he? So I just felt pretty disrespected by Russell, and I said, look, I'm not going to sign for that. I'm not asking for Premier League money, but I think I'm just due a little bit more. And it wasn't big money by any stretch. I was pretty happy to take a lesser wage than I was on. You know, I was asking for less than, I think, half of what I was on at Palace, just to move back to Brighton and be close to family and friends. And in the end, Russell came back to me with a pretty average offer, and I said, I had nothing on the table at the time, but then the agent got back to me around this Wellington Phoenix deal, and I thought, oh, well, if you're not going to live at home, you might as well live as far away as you can. So off we went.
That is quite a move. Obviously, you thought about it for a long time, but did you know much about the A-League?
No. So what happened is I was at Palace, and I was, like I said, I was injured all the time. I knew I had to go somewhere else. So my contract was up. They offered me a new deal, but I just thought I've got to find somewhere else to go. I was playing with Nick Carr, who was from Australia, and we were in the gym one day, both rehabbing injuries actually. And he said, "Have you ever thought about playing in a different league?" I said, "Oh yeah, maybe I'd like to play in America." And he said, "Have you thought about playing in the Australian A League?" And I said, "Well, not really, but I said if you've got somebody who could get me out there, then let me know." And he put me in touch with his agent. His agent called me up, and I got a deal all sorted to Central Coast Mariners, actually. I was going there as a marquee, good money. Everything was cool. I'd been down with my missus to see the parents and let them know that we were leaving. And I told my mum we were leaving. And little did I know, but Central Coast Mariners were part-owned by Sheffield United. And the day the deal was supposed to be done, one of the directors rang through from Central Coast to Sheffield and said, "We just about to sign Paul Eiffel as a marquee. Any thoughts on this?" I said, "Look, don't sign him. He's injury prone, liable to go missing, blah, 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 blah." So that was it. The deal was scuppered. So back to the drawing board for me. That's when I was contacted by Brighton and a couple of other clubs in England.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, the Wellington Phoenix had been in contact with the agent and said, "We need a centre forward." So the agent rang me, said, "Would you be interested in going? They need a number 9. I said, "Well, I'm not really a number 9. And he said, "Look, don't worry about that. Just we'll pretend you're a 9. And we'll sort the rest out when you get there." So in the meantime, I'm at Brighton. I turned down the Brighton deal. And then I rang my missus and said, "Look, I've had enough of this. Should we just go? Let's just go to New Zealand. God knows what it's going to be like. But if we do well, I can go to Australia after a year. And if we don't like it, we can always come home." So that was it. Straight out to New Zealand. And we're still here.
Did you move in the summer?
Yeah, I moved in July. So I went from a pretty good English summer to Wellington, which was ridiculously cold
and windy,
and windy, and the rain's coming in sideways, and I'm thinking, oh my God, what have I done here?
I'm surprised you didn't get on the next plane home.
Well, the thing was, the people were so friendly, I couldn't get over it. I couldn't, and that was really what got me across the line, because I did. There was a couple of wobbles where I thought I've made the wrong move here, but honestly, the people were so friendly, it was frightening.
No, New Zealand's a great place to live. How did you find the Wellington Phoenix as a club to play for?
At the start, it was good for me because the level was a lot lower than I was used to playing back home in the Championship.
Did you start playing and go, "Well, this is a doddle"?
No, I did. The first year was so easy, it was frightening. It was just what I needed, though, because I was trying to come back from injury, and I ended up playing every single game that year. so it sort of reset my body, and I had a good year, scored a lot of goals, a lot of assists. Everything pretty much went well for me. And again, I think it was because, you know, a lot of friendly people. I was feeling good about myself, and I knew that I could have an impact in the league. And the good thing about it was, although the level wasn't as high, the level of professionalism was pretty high. So they were trying to do the right things, and they were trying to build, you know, a decent club, which is still around now.
Yeah, definitely. And I think at that time, the Phoenix were doing pretty well. I mean, you were challenging in your first couple of seasons.
Yeah, we got to the playoffs for I think the first three seasons we got to the playoffs. We lost in the first year, we lost in the semi-final to Sydney, who ended up losing in the final to Melbourne Victory, I think. And the following year, we got to the playoffs again. And the year after that, I think we lost in the semis to Perth. So we had a good few years there.
Forgetting the football, how did you find the move over to New Zealand? Sort of going all that way, moving your family over. It's a big move. Did you think you would be staying, or do you think, oh, this is going to be a couple of years and I'll come back to England?
Yeah, I thought it'd be short and sweet. I thought it'd be a year or two. I came over with my fiance, and at the time, my only daughter. But after 2 years, we realised we were probably going to stay, so we had another one. My mum and her partner now live here. My sister and her partner live here. Ellie's, who's my fiance, her mum and dad live here, and her brother lives here. So they've all moved out.
I haven't really met anybody that's regretted it, to be honest with you.
Yeah, me too.
Apart from Steve, he's always moaning.
I'm a whinging pom, you know that.
Paul, do you miss the football back home, though?
Yeah, I do. That's one of the only things I miss it from. I miss a few friends, and I miss the football and the atmosphere around the football. I just don't think you can beat an away day in England. I think there's nothing quite like it. That's probably the only thing, like the atmosphere around, you know, the build-up to the game, you know, all week. Like you said already, you're talking about the derby against Palace, and you know, you've got another game in the way, but that's how it works. And then, you know, if you're working somewhere like Sutton or Crawley, you've got bragging rights for the next couple of weeks, haven't you, over your mates at work and stuff. It's just you don't quite get that here.
Just talking about the atmosphere in the stadium, because you were playing at the Cake Tin, where a big stadium, really nice stadium, but probably only a third full when you played. Did you find that quite disconnecting when you were playing, because you're quite used to sort of, you know, quite a ferocious atmosphere sometimes when you're playing?
No, I didn't actually. Some away games were awful, if I'm honest. There was times when you go to, you know, Gold Coast and there'd be 2,000 people there and you could hear, you know, everybody talking. It was horrible. But I have to say, the Yellow Fever were excellent. And like you said, it was about a third full. There was sometimes somewhere between 10 and 12, but they made it feel like it was double that. And they were really, really good fan base at the Phoenix, I have to say.
How do you think the A-League has improved since you've been over here? Or has it improved?
Oh, it's definitely improved, but I think it's improved because of the coaching more than anything. I think there's two things that have improved it. The age that they're bringing players out now is lower. You know, you look at the likes of, for instance, Roy O'Donovan. Those guys would have been coming over at 36, 37. And now you're getting guys at sort of 28, 29, 30 coming out, and it just adds to the league. So I think the recruitment has got better, and I think the coaches have got better. The likes of Ange Postecoglou, Kevin Muscat, Graham Arnold, all these guys now are very, very good coaches in their own right, and I think that helps because it's bringing the level of the local Australian up as well. You know, I don't think, you know, 5-6 years ago, an Aaron Moy would have been ready to go and play in the Premier League, but he's been excellent, and I think that's you know, that's down to some of the coaching he got over here before he left.
What sort of level would you compare it with in the UK?
Tough one, because, you know, although I thought Aaron was a very good player, I didn't think he'd be able to go and play in the Premier League as he did, but he can. So I'm not going to for a minute say that, you know, it's at Premier League level by any stretch, but I think it's somewhere around probably top of League One, something like that, bottom of the Championship, maybe. I'm not saying the teams over here would mix it with them teams, because I think they'd be too fit and too strong physically. But I think on a one-off game, I don't see why Sydney couldn't go and beat, you know, the odd Championship team here and there.
When you look at the national sides of New Zealand and Australia, there's a big mix of actual quality of player. Some players play for top teams in Europe, and then there's other players that play real far down the leagues. I think one of the All Whites played for Salford when I saw them playing.
Yeah, Max Croker.
Yeah.
Max Crocombe, the goalkeeper, played for Salford, and Rory Fallon played for Dorchester.
Yeah, I thought that was quite interesting. Do you follow the All Whites?
Yeah, I do, absolutely. Yeah, I do. And, you know, obviously disappointed they didn't make it to the World Cup, but I think it was a bridge too far. But I think, like you said, I think we need to get more players playing in top leagues. But it is happening. I look at the squad now. I think you've got Ryan Thomas at Zwolle in the Eredivisie. You've got Marco Rojas, who's at Heerenveen in the same league. Obviously, you've got Reed and Wood playing in the Premier League. You've got a couple of players in the Championship now. Clayton Lewis has just moved to Scunthorpe in top of League One. So the squad's getting better. You're getting players, or you get scouts, obviously, to these games and watching what's going on out here. And like you said, Australia's the same. They've got players, a lot of players playing in the Bundesliga now. So, you know, both national teams are definitely on the improve.
Do you think it would benefit the All Whites to join the Asia World Cup qualifier?
In the short term, no, because they wouldn't get anywhere near a World Cup and they wouldn't win too many games. But I think in the long term, definitely. It's the only way to get meaningful games. And that's no disrespect to the confederation they're in. But, you know, the games against your Vanuatu and your Solomon Islands, they have to win them. There's not enough competition there. Mm. They need to be going and playing your Irans and your Iraqs, your Saudi Arabias, your Australias. That's the sort of level that they need to aspire to get to, I think.
I do feel they're a little unfortunate to play Peru in their qualifying game, where Australia played Honduras, who are absolutely terrible.
Yeah, I'd like to have seen them swap round, because I think actually Australia could have probably beaten Peru still. And we might have snuck past Honduras and we both could have made it.
And it would have given the country a real football buzz as well. One thing I find is, and you may know this now, is that grassroots football over here is actually pretty good.
Oh, brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. They're really trying to do the right things and build from the bottom. And it's great. Obviously, I'm pretty heavily involved in some of the stuff that they're doing, but it is very enjoyable.
This is the Albion Roar Down Under, sponsored by Pure Media. Let's just go back to the Crystal Palace-Brighton rivalry. Okay, Steve, so I want to ask you about your most memorable Crystal Palace-Brighton game.
There's been a few down the years. I remember, I think the first game I went to was a 2-0 win at home in 76. I think we went 11 games unbeaten against Palace, which was quite a feat in itself.
Obviously, the one that comes to mind is the Paul McShane goal that gave us the victory in 2005 away at Selhurst Park. You spoke to Paul Reid. He shared some memories about the game.
Yeah, I've got really good memories of that game. I think everyone knows that Brighton won the game 1-0 with a Paul McShane goal, but I still believe it was an own goal that game. But anyway, it was still a goal. We were actually struggling for a bit of form, I remember, at the time, and went up to Selhurst Park and got a really good result, and did not realise the rivalry until supporters spoke to me after the game and told me all about it. And, you know, after the game, I had numerous phone calls from friends who had been at the game. They were travelling back on the train, and some of them were in pubs, and they were telling me that it was going crazy in the pubs. And, you know, we don't condone it, but there might have been a few fights going on when they were going from Selhurst to the train station. So, yeah, as I said, I didn't really realise the rivalry until after that game. But, you know, I've played in front of big crowds before, in grand finals, even the playoff game in 2004. And that game against Palace, I still remember very fondly, just because of the atmosphere at the game. I'm not sure what the crowd they get there. I think it's only in the high 20s at the time, but I just remember the atmosphere was unbelievable, especially with the supporters being so close to the ground. So, yeah, I've got really good memories, and it's probably up there with one of the three highlights of my career, really. I'm not just saying it. As I said, I speak to a lot of people about it, and as I said, I hadn't experienced that sort of atmosphere at a game, and, you know, it was really great.
Okay, you are listening to the Albion Roar Down Under podcast, sponsored by Pure Media, the full-service video production company based here in Auckland. Visit www.pureproductions.co.nz for more information on how Pure can create a fully customised, crafted video for your business. Also, if you'd like to get in touch with us, our email is albionroardownunder@gmail.com. Get in touch if you'd like to be part of the show, or if you have any views or issues Albion-related you'd like us to discuss. Okay, so let's talk about the game on Wednesday. How badly do we want to win this game?
We want to win it, but a draw is not the end of the world. A loss, on the other hand, is. But is it really in the great scheme of things? I mean, obviously we want to win. That's the main objective. We want to have the bragging rights. It's the whole season, and if we're worrying about one game, then there's something completely wrong. We obviously want to beat the teams around us, but like we said on the last podcast, you know, the teams up in the top six, we don't worry about them. If we go to Man United on Saturday and sneak a 0-0 draw, you know, we'll be chuffed to bits, but realistically, the top six, seven teams, we're not worried about. So teams around us, teams below us, those are the teams we've got to pick the points up against.
Now, when this game was, or when the fixtures came out and we all had a look, and we saw this game was going to be one of the last games in the first round of games, if you like, that would be played. I don't think any of us thought Palace would be doing as bad as they have been. Does this raise the expectations of the Brighton fans now?
Yeah. I think every Brighton fan will be thinking, you know, we should go out and win this quite comfortably. But to be fair, Palace have got a fair side. And I've watched them play two or three times this season, and to be fair, they've been a bit unlucky. And they have got good players, you know, there's no doubt about that. But they're just not sort of clicking. They've spent a far superior amount on their squad than we have now. I don't know why they're underachieving. Swapping and changing the managers doesn't help. You know, we've seen that before. It'll probably happen at West Ham as well. Moyes, I don't think he'll last long to be honest. I think he'd be out by about February. You'll probably see the same with Hodgson.
They are seen as safe appointments, but are they? You know, Tony Pulis got sacked this week, and I read in the paper today that Alan Pardew is up for the West Brom job. Alan Pardew. I mean, that's not really forward thinking, is it?
You'd be a bit disappointed if he turned up at the club, wouldn't you? I think even the Palace fans were disappointed when he turned up at the club.
Paul, what do you think about this manager merry-go-round at the moment in the Premier League?
Yeah, I think it's pretty ridiculous. I mean, if you're replacing Pulis with Pardew, I think you're out of the frying pan into the fire. It's much of a muchness. That makes no sense to me. You know, go for somebody completely different. Go for somebody with new ideas, fresh ideas. You know, it seems really hard to get off the merry-go-round in the Premier League if you're on it. It seems you've got the job for life. It's crazy.
It's strange, actually, because Crystal Palace appointed Frank de Boer at the beginning of the season, and you would have said he was an out-of-the-box appointment. They gave him four games, and then they appointed Roy Hodgson, the safe choice. Everybody cries out for a manager of new ideas, but he doesn't get the time.
No, I agree. I mean, it's not always the way forward, but if you look at the blueprint of Burnley, they went a little bit outside the square and appointed Sean Dyche, and people moaning at the time, and he got them up from nowhere, and then they got relegated, and everybody said, "Oh, it'll be off now. He's relegated. They'll replace him with somebody else." But they knew that he knew the league. They knew that he knew how to get out of the Championship, and that when he got back in the Premier League, he'd know what he did wrong the first time round because he's a smart guy. And look what he's doing now with a shoestring budget. He's, you know, for me, he's been the best coach in the Premier League this season.
I think with Sean Dyche, as a player, just the look of him brings fear to your eyes, I think. You don't want to mess with that guy.
No, he was my teammate at Millwall for a couple of years.
Was he a hard player?
He was, but he's not as hard as you think. He looks like that, but he was a proper thinker. And you could see way before it, maybe even he knew, he was always going to be a good coach. I'm not saying I could foretell the future and thought he was going to do what he's doing now, but I knew he was going to have a better coaching career than playing career. And he was always trying to give advice to us younger players, which we didn't listen to, by the way, which we had on. But yeah, no, he was always going to go on and do good things as a coach. And you know, he can be a tough guy, but I tell you what, he puts his arm around your shoulder as well when you need it.
As a player, how unsettling is it to individual players and a team when there is a change of manager? Or do you think, glad he's gone?
Yeah, exactly. It can be. But I remember when I was a youngster, Mark McGee got sacked, and I was absolutely devastated. I went in his office and I was nearly in tears. I was saying sorry that I'd done more for you to keep you at the club because he'd been a massive part of my career up to that point, and I wouldn't have achieved anything like I did in the game without his input. But at other times, there were guys that got sacked, and I won't name any names, but you know, the boys were hugging and kissing and jumping for joy because, you know, they've been seen as a tyrant. I mean, management is a funny thing, and it does funny things to people. I've seen coaches on the brink of breakdowns, and you know, them resigning is the best thing for their mental health at times. So it's a crazy place, man, being a manager.
I guess that's something that's not really ever highlighted, is the stress that goes, you know, with managing a football club? I mean, obviously, top clubs, you can see stress on the managers' faces, but again, they're actually quite good at hiding it. But actually, deep down, the mental stress it does take.
Oh, I've seen coaches doing all sorts of crazy stuff, and you wonder why. And then, you know, I've spoken to a couple of guys that have been sacked in their careers when I've been playing for them, and you speak to them afterwards, and they say, "Look, I don't really know what I was doing. I'd completely lost the plot. I was under so much stress and blah blah blah." And you think, "Blah, man!" At the time, you don't even realise that. You think that, you know, the manager's got it out for you or whatever, but he's dealing with so many different things, and trying to get, you know, a team together and trying to get 3 points. That's what it boils down to. And sometimes you think, oh, you know, I'm going to play the centre half up front this week because we're going to go long, and so everybody else can see that it's the most stupid idea in the world. But you can convince yourself that you know this is going to work, and then obviously it doesn't, and you find yourself closer to the sack. And I think you know, there needs to be people monitoring these guys and making sure that they're not you know, one step from toppling over the edge.
Yeah, definitely. And players, you just touched on it there, players do feel guilty when a manager gets sacked.
Yeah, sometimes. Like I said, it depends on the situation. Honestly, I was at Palace, and I won't say who, but you better work it out from Google. But there was a manager got sacked there, and to be fair, I thought it was the best thing the club could have done until bloody Neil Warnock was appointed straight away afterwards. So that didn't work out so well for me. But the rest of the boys at the club were very happy that the coach had got sacked, and we got fresh impetus, and you know, things did get better. But like I said, with McGee, for me personally, he'd done so much for my career up to that point that I was devastated, and as were most of the younger boys. But looking back, it was probably the senior boys that had got him out of the club, because they've got more power than the junior boys, and they you know, they get together, and when things go badly, all the younger boys follow the senior boys. That's just kind of how it works, and they would have managed to get him out of the club, and they'd have been happy. And then as it happened, Dennis Wise came in and did a pretty good job himself.
Did Mark McGee then go to Brighton?
Yes, he did. Yes.
Oh, so our gain then?
Yeah, no, he was great at Brighton. He was great at Brighton. So, yeah. And another one, I mean, I bumped into him probably about 18 months after. I had a night out with him, actually, in Brighton. I was playing. I was still at Millwall, and I was injured, as usual. And I had a night out with Mark McGee and Dennis Wise, actually.
Where did you go?
Blimey, went to the marina, of all places, for a bite to eat and a few drinks.
Oh, awesome. Okay, just talking about managers, so who was the best manager you played under?
I would say Mark McGee. I've been very, very impressed with Brett Angel here. He was my coach for Hawke's Bay 2 years ago. I was assistant under him, and he was very, very good to learn from. But in terms of being just a player and having somebody to really, I suppose, change your career, Mark McGee would stand out for me.
So Brett Angel is managing in the New Zealand League?
Yeah, the New Zealand National League, yeah. He's the Hawke's Bay head coach, yeah.
Oh, wow, okay. Okay, so we're going to do a few quick-fire questions, unless Steve wants to add anything.
I was going to go back to the, you know, you were saying about the mental health of managers and everything else, but...
Yeah, go on.
Is it not a lot easier now with the managers that they have such a big backroom staff and everything else compared to managers of previous years in the 70s and 80s who seem to be doing it all on their own? You know, no, apart from maybe, you know, Brian Clough with Peter Taylor, there wasn't too many second-in-commands along with these managers. Whereas nowadays, you know, you've got your assistant coach where they sort of, you know, help share the burden a bit. Is that not a lot easier for managers?
Yeah, yes and no, because I suppose it depends on the personality for one. Because if you're the sort of guy, even if you've got an assistant coach that doesn't like to delegate, then you're still going to take the brunt of it regardless. And what you've got to remember is that the assistant coach is never the first one to be sacked. It's always the head coach. It's always the manager. And the assistant coach either gets the job or he goes with. So although they do share the burden and they can share the coaching, it's the main guy that's always got his head on the chopping block, and he's the one that's searching for those points. And I think that's what makes it tougher being a manager rather than a head coach.
But the same thing is that if you've got an assistant coach, obviously you can confide in that assistant coach, whereas back in the day, you know, back in the 70s, 80s, Who would you go to confide with?
Yeah, definitely. Depend. Yeah, I think you're right in terms of that. There's definitely more support around, but depends on your personality. I've had coaches that have got assistant coaches and don't use them in the right way, and don't confide in them enough, and you know, don't give them time to put their own sessions on, etc., etc. So even though you've got somebody there, if you're not willing to use them, I suppose you probably still feel quite lonely at times.
I mean, I think the first time we sort of saw that at the Albion was with Mark and Bob Booker. I can't remember too many other sort of double acts, if you like.
Well, when Mickey Adams joined the club, didn't he bring, was it Alan Cork he brought as assistant manager?
Oh, yes, he did. Yeah.
Right. And they were a bit of a double act. And then Alan Cork went somewhere, I can't remember it was. And was that when Bob Booker came in?
That's when Bob Booker came in with Mickey Adams, and then that went a bit pear-shaped with Mickey Adams, and he stayed on, didn't he?
Yeah, that's right. But Bob Booker was, I guess, he had such a strong personality, both with the players and with the crowd, that I guess that's why we remember him more. But also that he had that longevity with different managers coming in and out. And Dick Knight said to the new manager coming, you have to work with Bob Booker, rather than kicking out all of the managerial staff and starting again.
The thing with Bob is that he was one of the lads, really, wasn't he? Mm. He really was the go-between Mickey Adams or Mark McGee and the players. You know, I think Mark McGee or Mickey would have instructed some sort of training session, and Bob Booker would go and implement it. You know, and he would have a laugh with the players, and it was almost like the double act, wasn't it? The straight man and the comedian.
If you haven't heard the Albion Raw UK version, they've got a two-part episode of the night that they talked to Mark McGee and Bob Booker about their time at the Albion. It's very interesting stuff. There's a few stories, but it's a real good insight into how the pair worked. Anyway, let's move on. So, Paul, I just want to ask you a few quick-fire questions. Favourite goal?
Yeah. Favourite goal? Blimey. I scored a hat-trick for Millwall, my only hat-trick for Millwall, and it was the third one. It was about 25, 30 out, left foot, top corner.
Wow. Okay, good memory. Do you remember... Okay, this is going to sound like a stupid question. Do you remember most of your goals?
Most, not all. The tap-ins, I forget, because they're pretty boring. But the long-range strikes, or, you know, if you do a little twist or turn or a trick or something in the lead-up, or it's a nice team goal, you remember those goals definitely.
And about the important goals as well.
Yeah, I mean, like a last-minute match winner or one... I mean, I always remember the goal in the replay against Telford, in the rearranged game against Telford, and I think it was round four to get through to play Burnley. And that was a big goal, because we were playing on the horrendous pitch, and it wasn't even a very good goal. It was a deflected goal, but... You know, part of that sort of magical run to the final.
Yeah, definitely. Favourite game?
Favourite game was the semi-final against Sunderland. I only played the first half an hour. I got injured and had to be bloody stretched off. But just even talking about it, my hair's standing up now. It was a crazy game, and we held on to win 1-0. I set up the goal for Tim Cahill, and then came off after injuring myself in the celebration. Done my groin.
Tim Cahill, he must have been a player to play alongside.
He was unbelievable. This sounds ridiculous, but he wouldn't even be on the top 10 of the best players I've played with in terms of technique. But in terms of what he did in his career, well, he'd be top. So he made, you know, use of every little bit that he had in him. He was such a hard worker and deserves everything he's managed to do in the game.
And he's got this reputation for being one of the best headers of a ball as well.
He's the best I've ever played with. It's just ridiculous. His timing was frightening, you know. And I've played with some guys who can head the ball, Dion Dublin and guys like that. And Timmy was just second to none, honestly.
When you got injured in that semi-final, at the end of the game, did you think, yes, we're through to the final? And then did you think, I might miss it? Or was it not a serious
injury? I tore my groin, so I was out. I think I ended up in out about 3.5 weeks. But on the day, I didn't know how bad it was. I could hardly walk. And it was a bittersweet feeling. Obviously, I was so happy for the lads and the thought of playing at Cardiff. And, you know, we knew that the other semi was Man U Arsenal. So we knew that we were playing somebody enormous. But then it was just a race against time to get fit. And in the end, I made it pretty comfortably. And there wasn't really an issue.
Cool. Favourite teammate? Now, it doesn't have to be the best player you've played with. Just your favourite teammate.
I've probably got a couple from each club, if I'm honest.
Yep,
it's quite tough. I mean, it's Joe Dolan, who was a mate of mine. He now lives in Australia, actually. He was a great lad from when I started out at Millwall. Obviously, Tim Cahill was there with him and another lad, Stephen Reid, who played for Ireland. So those three at Millwall. Got a couple of lads from Sheffield United. Phil Jagielka was a good mate, as was Nick Montgomery, who's now at Central Coast Mariners. Palace, Matt Lawrence, the guy I played with at Millwall and at Palace. So one of my really long-term mates. And then at the Phoenix, a couple of guys, probably Andrew Durante would be one of my best mates, Vince Leo and Manny Muscat and a few guys there. So quite fortunate that I've made some good friends along the way.
Are you still in contact with Durante? Because he went to Peru.
Yeah, I speak to him weekly. Yeah. So he's obviously devastated that he didn't make the World Cup. So it'll probably be his last appearance. But he's had a pretty good run at it.
Did he give you the lowdown of how crazy it was out there with the fans? And I read stories in the NZ Herald about fireworks going off at 3 a.m. and then massive jets passing over. Just completely unfair.
Yeah, but I think it's because we're not used to it. I look and I've read some stories from other places, and that's just the norm, you know. Do what you've got to do. Do what you've got to do. It's a World Cup. So if you have to fly, get your military out, if you have to go and get some fireworks out, if you have to put the fire alarm off, do what you've got to do and make sure your team get there.
Yeah, fair enough. And you don't have to answer this, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Least favourite teammate?
Least favourite teammate, blimey.
Do I sense that there might be a few?
There's lots, to be honest. There's lots, yeah. There's always a couple at every club. And I don't think it's fair to name any names. There's no one that stands out. There's probably... I could put a team together, maybe. I'll have to get back to you next time on that one.
yeah, fair enough. Okay, so finally, Paul, let's talk about the Paul Eiffel Soccer Academy. So how did this come about, and when did you set it up?
It came about when I first came out, the second year I was out here, I was contacted by a lad on Facebook, asked me to come down and do some after dinner speaking in Nelson on the South Island. So I went down and did that. We had a night out afterwards, got on really well with him. He said, look, if you ever think about doing an academy, come down here. There's some great kids down there. But everywhere I go, people tell me that, you know, you go to Auckland, the best kids are here, you go to Christchurch, same thing. So I took it with a pinch of salt, and that was that. Following year, he invited me down for a different function, came down again. I was staying the next day. He said, look, just come and have a look at some of the local games and see what you think. So I went and had a look. I was blown away. Some of the stuff down there was brilliant. So I said, look, I can't do anything at the moment. I'm still playing. But I said, when I retire, let's talk again and we'll see what goes on. So I ruptured my Achilles in 2013. About 2 weeks after that, he's on the phone. So now that you've finished playing, I said, hold on a minute. I said, let me at least do the rehab and try and come back. So during the rehab, we talked about how we'd set it up if I didn't make it. And I probably got about 8 to 10 months into the rehab and realised that I was really, you know, struggling. So we set the academy up on the South Island, and that's where it began. And now I've got one on the North Island where we live. So we've got around about 120 kids training. You know, most are training sort of 3 or 4 days a week. So things are going pretty well.
So what sort of age groups? What age do you start at?
When we very first started, it was 11 to 16 and two groups. So we sort of had 11, 12 and 13s together and 14, 15, 16s. And it was seen as an elite academy. You had to trial to get in. But again, looking at the grassroots stuff, you just have to make sure the level gets up, you know, from a base level and everybody's improving together. So we've gone right down to 5, right up to 18. And basically, you know, the 5-year-olds, it's just about getting them touches on the ball. We're not going in and teaching them how to play out from the back and stuff like that at 5 years old, but you know, just basic technical stuff, teaching them how to pass, how to dribble, how to shoot, and then we move on through. We're talking about going into nurseries at some point over next year and actually helping the real youngsters just with, you know, real basic stuff, you know, being able to trap a ball, being able to catch a ball, just some motor skills and stuff like that.
And what's the end game? Are you hoping these players then progress to play professionally?
Yeah, I mean, the way I see it, we're just trying to help kids improve, and that's all we can really offer. Anything else after that is a bonus. But you know, I've got guys who are sort of coming out the other end now who are playing National League football at 18, and certainly if things keep going the right way, they'll either end up going and getting a US scholarship, or they'll go to some of my former clubs. I'm hoping next year that I send one boy off to Millwall. I actually sent Clayton Lewis over to Millwall a couple of years ago.
Okay.
And they wanted to sign him. Couldn't get his visa sorted, and obviously he came back and went back over again, and is now at Scunthorpe. So I was obviously right in sending him. He was good enough. So there's definitely kids here that are good enough to play professionally overseas.
Are you planning on setting one up in Auckland?
No, because I think that's covered, if I'm honest. I quite like giving back to the little guy. That's one reason why we started in Nelson. Now we're in the Wairarapa. If I was to start another one, it would be somewhere like Hawke's Bay or Taupo, somewhere where they don't get much. In Auckland, you've got the Phoenix Academy, you've got Winners, you've probably got a lot of others that I don't know about. So it's the same in Wellington, and that was one of the reasons why we decided we'd do something somewhere else.
Oh, that's excellent. No, it's really good. Yeah, my son's just started playing, and I've been desperate to get him into playing football. So those kind of academies are definitely most welcome.
Yeah, thank you.
So I think that's just about it for us. All right, Paul, thanks very much for talking to us.
Yeah, thanks,
no
Paul.
Problem.
And
no problem
at all. Good luck with the academy, and hopefully we'll see you at the Renfrew game next year.
Lovely, yeah, absolutely. Thanks, guys.
You are listening to the Albion Roar Down Under podcast, sponsored by Pure Media. If you'd like to get in touch, please email us, albionroardownunder@gmail.com. Next episode should be hitting the airwaves maybe in 2 weeks' time. Until then, bye for now. Thanks for listening.